This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
It's Friday. Gotta get down on Friday. Welcome to the IGN UK podcast with me, Simon Cardi. And it's a double Matt special again. First up, we've got Matt Jones. Hello.
Welcome to Matt Sandwich, Cardi.
Hello. Thank you very much. Matt Perslow.
Hello.
Are you a lovely slice of wholemeal right now, or are you, what are you feeling?
No, I see myself more as kind of like a, like maybe like a malted rye or something like
that. Oh, okay. You are quite rye as a person, I suppose.
I feel like I'm kind of pita bread, like, you know, got a rough exterior.
That's a weird
but
sandwich if I've got malted rye on one side and a pita on the other. That is an odd sandwich.
I've never thought about making a sandwich with two different types of bread.
Has it ever been done? I mean, you can get a like best of both bread, can't you, where they mix white and like a whole
I guess wholemeal. To a very minor element, maybe the Taco Bell crunch wrap is sort of this, in that it's got crunchy tortilla and soft tortilla.
Yeah, or the, I think we talked about, well, I don't know if Tesco still do it, their like Christmas sandwich, which is like a brioche roll with a Yorkshire pudding in it.
That's gross, though. That's really bad.
But is it, though?
It's horrible.
Though? Or does it taste fantastic?
gravy mayo? That's grotesque.
It works. Anyway,
I don't know why it's like the genius.
Do you know who else loved
to be the ones that come up with that?
Do you know who loved making things like gravy mayo? J. Robert Oppenheimer.
He's the inventor of
the
many
gravy
things.
Mayo. That is his most famed feat. We are going to talk. What are we going to do this week? We're going to talk about Oppenheimer. We're also going to rank IGN UK's top 10 Nolan films. I've got rankings from everyone that I've kept secret, so no one apart from me knows what this list is for ranking the Nolan films. So that'll be lovely. We can talk a bit about each of those. And we've got a few games we've been playing we've got brief to talk about. What a bumper lovely show. First up, though, we haven't seen Barbie. We'll talk about Barbie next week because none of us have had the chance to see it yet. But I am very excited to see Barbie. And that'll be next week. So if you're expecting Barbie chat, I'm sorry. You have to wait a week.
To do a Barbenheimer episode. It would have been,
exactly.
For posterity. But
maybe we can
Warner Brothers. Not inviting us.
Exactly. Like, it's almost like, you know, one of those is one side of that sandwich. They're two different bits of bread, and I want to be in the middle of that Barbenheimer sandwich. But let's talk about Oppenheimer. I'll set the stage. If you don't know what Oppenheimer is, it is a biopic film of J. Robert Oppenheimer, the father of the atomic bomb, set during World War II, directed by Christopher Nolan, who I'm sure many of you know who that is. It's as much a film about the creation of the bomb as it is the man himself. A surprising amount of this film is actually takes place in courtrooms and little rooms like post the atomic bomb. It's as much a Cold War film as it is a World War II atomic bomb film. And it's kind of, I suppose, the shorthand if you're looking for a way this film is structured, because you know Christopher Nolan never likes to keep things linear. He's going to dart all around the place. Think The Social Network. If all the Jesse Eisenberg courtroom scenes are kind of them going through the story, it's a little bit like that, but slightly more complex. That's kind of setting the scene for this film. I'll talk to you. Only me and Matt J have seen this so far. Matt P, I'm sorry, you have to wait, but I think it's worth the wait. Matt, what do you think about this film first? I know you're a little cooler on it than me.
Yeah, I don't think it rates among my favourites that he's produced, but I did very much enjoy the time with it. I think that a lot of people have cooled on the latter half of the film, which I actually think is some of the most interesting stuff that happens in it. Like, some of the reviews have said that it does mm-hmm. what it intends to and then kind of continues for a little yeah. while. But I think that the structure of that last little bit of the film is about mm-hmm. the pettiness and smallness of the people that get to make the decision of what happens with this gigantic thing. Mm-hmm. Like, he's changed the world and has put it in the hands of fallible yeah. people, and it's dealing with the consequences for all of that. And the
it's
stuff
very
that-
much... it's like a serious Doctor Strangelove in a way, if you've seen that. I will say we're not going to spoil this film as much as you can't spoil an 80-year-old historical yeah,
it
event.
It did happen
We're not going to spoil it. Because there are things people won't know. There are things in this film, like, I'm a big, like, Cold War, like, history. This is, like, my era. I love this sort of stuff, like, McCarthyism and all that. Like, I really love studying that at school. But, like, there are things here I didn't know. So, like, there will be, like, you know, there are things to spoil despite it being a story. But we're not going to do that, so don't worry. But yeah, sorry, Matt, carry on.
Yeah, of course. I think that that's the part that really, the more that I think about the film afterwards, like, you'll hear everybody talk about, and you did an amazing interview with the man himself, Chris Nolan, that you can watch, about the production of the Trinity test that I thought was great. Like, it's a grand spectacle, and you'll hear a lot about that. But I think that you won't hear so much about the small scenes of character interaction. Amazing performance by Robert Downey Jr. as well on this. Like,
I think everyone in this film, the acting is like on point. But obviously, Cillian Murphy as Oppenheimer as the lead, like, does a lot and is very, very good. But yeah, I think I agree with you. Robert Downey Jr. for me, like, stole every scene he was in. Like, this is the best I've ever seen him act. Like, yeah, he's very good.
It'd be difficult to say that he's done anything better. Yeah.
Yeah,
Gary Oldman in a tiny little scene, like
Gary Oldman popping up. All the Nolan favorites. I will. Is this a spoiler? No, Michael Caine. I'm afraid.
Yeah, sure.
No Michael Caine scene. I'm hotter on this film than you think, Matt. I think this is a borderline masterpiece. I absolutely love this film. I've only seen it once. I need to see it again because it is a very dense film. It's a 3-hour film that goes at a pace. Like, despite it being not an action heavy film, like, there's a lot of talking and it keeps it going. Like, you're going through the years, you're going, like, especially the middle hour where it's all kind of centered around the Trinity test and the bomb itself. Like, that just flies by, and the tension they managed to create on an event, you know exactly how it's gonna go. Like, if you know anything about history, you know that this, you know, this bomb test is gonna, you know, what the result of it's gonna be. But they still somehow managed to keep that tension that at any point they could destroy the world. Which, you know, that's the big thing at play. Have they really destroyed the world by not actually destroying it? But this film has, like, so many great films, and I think that's why inside it, that's why I love it so much. Like, it is kind of, I tweeted this when I first saw it, like, it is weird, The Prestige is the film of his that it reminds me of the most. And I think
totally
it's because
that,
it's got,
yeah.
like, it's got kind of like the warring between, like, people. It's almost like if you've seen Amadeus, it's a little bit like that relationship at the core of this film. I don't want to spoil who that's between, but I just love it. And the way the kind of Prestige is kind of like a courtroom drama to a point where they're reading their diaries and looking back at stories. It's kind of structured similarly to that. It's also got quite a little bit of There Will Be Blood to it, not only because it's a man on a mission building a whole village in a New Mexico desert to try and do a project. But yeah, I just, like I said, like, the acting is on point. I think if there's a couple of things over Nolan's career that people have kind of always, like, pinpointed that he doesn't do too well, is A, like, bring an emotion into his films, which I don't actually agree with. I think not all of his films do it, but I think Inception does have an emotional core to it. Interstellar is a fully emotional film to me, and, like, that is one where I think he did actually prioritise emotion over plot to an extent, and that's why it gets a little bit messy. But I think, like, yeah, Interstellar hits. And for me, we'll talk about these later, but Dunkirk, I don't think there's a film that is guaranteed to make me tear up more than Dunkirk. Like, that is a hugely emotional film to me, and that's not really done through, it's done all through music and, like, action, really. Like, he's just, I really do think he does that stuff well. And while Oppenheimer doesn't, at no point was I close to tearing up in Oppenheimer, it hits you in a different sort of way emotionally, I think. Like, it, when it finishes, you do kind of feel empty inside, but in a good way. I don't know how, like, it's you've been entertained.
The scale of the world that you've just been presented with.
Exactly.
Like, over the course of that amount of time, you've gotten, like, the very lows and the very, like, highs of what humanity is capable of over the course of a three-hour movie. You're presented with all of that at once, and you just kind of have to sit with it for a little bit.
Exactly, and it's just... I think it's, like, a borderline masterpiece. And I haven't really talked about the score, Ludwig Göransson's score. He is like top of the tree now for me for composers. Like, his score for Tenet is unbelievable. Like, Tenet itself, maybe not brilliant, but the score is unbelievable. And
it's specifically the use of quiet. And as soon as you see the film, you'll completely understand. But when it chooses to not have any score whatsoever is just as important. It's, completely essential.
And the other thing I was going to say, people have a go of not being a motion film. Also, he's never really been able to get a good grasp on his female characters at all, or give them a real good script, I'd say, or a good arc. I will say this has Florence Pugh and Emily Blunt in as two characters. One, Florence Pugh is very good, but she is much more used, I'd say, as a plot device. She's a real character, and these real things happened. Like, she is kind of another burden to Oppenheimer's life, ultimately, I think, on his mind. Whereas I think Emily Blunt, actually, especially in the last, like, half an hour of this film, really comes into it and, like, steals some scenes. Like, Emily Blunt is fantastic in this film. And
especially during the deposition. It's like some of the, like, the best dialogue is during her scene during the deposition. Like, it's really, really good.
I can't wait to see this film again, because, like I said, it's so dense. It goes by so quickly for a three-hour film that there's things I will have missed there, and knowing how it all turns out. And it does, for a weird film that's historically based, it does kind of two-thirds of the way through have that Nolan, like, and here's what was happening all along, like, twist thing. And you're like, oh my God. it is bizarre how he's managed to do that with a true story. And I just think, I absolutely love this film. Like, we'll do our group rankings in a bit, but my personal rankings, this is like number three on my Nolan film. I think it's very, very, very good.
It's number five for me, but we'll talk about that a little bit more.
Yeah. So I have a question in regards to it. It kind of links into kind of not necessarily criticisms of Nolan, but like examinations of his style. And Nolan has largely been someone that paints his characters in kind of slightly broader strokes, because he's more of a conceptual storyteller, where kind of like, you know, I agree with you that I think he can do emotion very well, but the emotion is more of a concept rather than kind of like necessarily, like in Dunkirk, for example. There are no characters in Dunkirk. They're all kind of archetypes that are designed to bring the emotions associated with those experiences out. And I think he does that. You know, that's a lot of what Interstellar is based on. And that's a lot of the emotion in Inception comes from as well.
Yeah.
I get the impression that really for Oppenheimer, it has to be a much more distinct character-based study where the characters are dealt with in much more nuance. Because ultimately, the story isn't about the making of the nuclear bomb. It's the all of the pain and regret and questioning
it's
that comes
with it. It's about Oppenheimer himself. Like, this is definitely the most character-based film he's ever done. Like, even Dunkirk, which is his only other non-fiction film, is very much like you said. Like, the events are true, but everything within it is fictionalized, and those characters didn't really exist. So I know what you mean. Like, the emotion is more connected to moment rather than like relating to a character
and grander feeling, right? Like, you are like Cillian Murphy's character in Dunkirk, like the shivering soldier, is representative of like an entire feeling that so many soldiers on that beach had. Whereas in this, we're dealing with people that, you know, Oppenheimer's kind of like, whilst his greatest worldwide legacy is the idea of kind of like he's the guy that made the reality of the atomic bomb. But like, if you read into him, like, he's a man that like was quite naive in a way. Like, he thought that this building this would end war forever.
And I think that comes across. Like, I think he does, obviously not knowing the man himself. I think he does quite a good job at painting a picture. You can definitely, like, it's hard to make a biopic and be completely objective, right? You have to kind of put your own spin on it and paint it. Just like documentary, you can't, you know, to a way, like, you're always kind of going to lean one way with, like, whether it's a Louis Theroux documentary, he's always going to be sympathetic or something. Like, and I do think you get the sense from this that Nolan, while obviously thinking a large portion of this is abhorrent, also has a lot of sympathy for Oppenheimer. I think ultimately he comes down on that side of it. Not too heavy, mm-hmm. but I do think the way this film ends, you are meant to feel more on Oppenheimer's side in all of this.
Oh, yeah, I absolutely have no issue. Yeah, I'm not looking for a film that hangs just for what he did. What I want is a film that is about individual character rather than the wider scope.
I do think you get that, and mm-hmm. I think you get an understanding of him as a man as much you can do in 3 hours. I think a lot of that is down to Cillian Murphy, who is just superb. Like, it is great to see him in the lead role in a Nolan film. I know he's been waiting a while for this, but yeah, he is absolutely astonishing, I think. But yeah, I think I'm looking forward to hearing what you think about it, Matt, because I know you're also a big Nolan fan and
I do like the similar sorts.
Yeah, and the same sort of Nolan films to me as well, because there are different types of Nolan films, which I suppose is a lovely segue to talk about other Nolan films. Obviously, How have I forgotten this email address? I've said about 5,000 times in my life. Oh my good God. IGN_UKfeedback@IGN.com. There we go. If you've seen Oppenheimer, let us know what you think.
And maybe Barbie where too. It ranks. Maybe we'll do that next week.
Exactly. Yeah, we'll read out some Barbie emails next week. That'll be fantastic. Let's get to our Nolan rankings. What I did here was I asked everyone who wanted to participate on our team to send in their favorite their rankings of Nolan films, whether you'd only seen like 7 of them or all 12 of them or whatever. I will say this doesn't include Oppenheimer, because only me and Matt have seen it, so what's the point of asking everyone to rank Oppenheimer when they haven't seen it? But
that'd be funny though. It'd be funny to get the list before and after they've seen it.
Yeah, not everyone's seen every film, so I've kind of had to do a little bit of weird mathematics here, just like Oppenheimer, really, to try and work out this ranking.
It's going to have the same consequence.
Exactly. So let's get straight into it. He's made 12 films, if you include Oppenheimer, so we're going to rank 11. Do you know what? I did 11, and I was going to do top 10, but you might as well just add them all, because actually, tied at the bottom are both Insomnia and Following. Have you seen Insomnia or Following?
I have not. These are the two that I haven't seen.
Okay, well, I actually think I'm the only one who's seen all of his films, so I should probably talk about Insomnia and Following. Which, you know what? It's rare that you... These are his two worst films, I think. But even that, I would say, they're like 6 and 7s. They're not bad films by any means. I don't think he's ever made a truly bad film. But yeah, if you don't know what Following is, it's the very first film he made. Like, he kind of shot it on like evenings while doing it like part time as a job. It's a noir film that follows. It's kind of like a noir crime thriller set in London. It's okay. You know, I wouldn't go seek it out desperately, but it's a decent thriller. Same with Insomnia. It's a remake of, I want to say, Norwegian, but I might be wrong. It is weird that he did a remake. You wouldn't strike as a man who did a remake, would you? Let me find. I don't want to get the country this was remade from. I think it is Norwegian, yep. Starring Al Pacino and Robin Williams. Pretty good. Like, this is his like first ever real, like, I suppose, big film, because Following's barely... You know, it's kind of a low budget indie film, really, but it's an okay like noir, again, like noir thriller that is set in Alaska. It's kind of got, it actually reminds me of what the upcoming season of True Detective might be a little bit like. If you've seen the trailer for the Jodie Foster one, it's kind of like some people hunting a killer in an Alaskan town. Again, though, I wouldn't seek it out. It's fine. It's absolutely fine. I don't have a lot to say about Insomnia, to be honest. Hilary Swank's pretty good in it.
I think this basically can be summed up by the fact of it took Spielberg 2 films to get to Jaws.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. These two films, watch them if you want to be a Nolan purist, but I wouldn't go too heavy on it. Let's get into the ones that, you know, not everyone's seen, but most people have seen. Number 9 on our list. So that was Following Insomnia, tied at 10, by the way. And number 9, we do have Tenet coming in at 9. Which is a little bit lower than I'd have it, but not by much. Matt, I know you've maybe you have something to get off your chest here, because I know you reviewed Tenet. It's a hard thing to review a film, especially when you've seen it once.
I mean, kind of like, you know, if anybody remembers us talking about Tenet on the podcast, I reviewed it, but also was in the tough situation which some film companies unfortunately put us in that I had to review it in about 4 hours. I didn't have a very long time, and I gave it an 8 at the time, which I think is in hindsight.
I'd give it a 7.
You know. Yeah, I think I would have given it a 7 in hindsight. And there were definitely things that I got wrong in that. I say got wrong, but in hindsight, I believe that my opinion has shifted on it. And maybe if I'd had a little bit longer time, that maybe I would have scored it slightly differently. But one of the things that I wrote is I thought that Ludwig Göransson's... I said his score felt like an imitation of Zimmer, and like that's just not true with a lot of hindsight. But also one of those things that really I only learned after listening to that score kind of like in isolation to a certain extent.
It's hard to I think film opinions, like I find this change over time more than game opinions. Like if I play a game, I kind of know what how I feel about
so
it.
So much time though in it, because a game is you're with it for a longer time, right? Mm-hmm. Even within the space of a film, you don't necessarily get that kind of downtime in it to consider why you're watching it, how you're feeling of it. Whereas games ebb and flow so much that you do get a little bit of downtime frequently in a game to consider what your feeling is, and you're going to be playing it for about 10 hours anyway.
I do think there is a lot to enjoy in Tenet. I think it looks amazing. The actual concept, like, I'm a sucker for a spy thriller, and it is a decent spy thriller. It's definitely the one where he got a bit too clever for his own good.
I think the one criticism that I put several criticisms in the review, actually, and the one that I think I definitely still hugely stand by is... it goes to the point where the concept becomes so like ephemeral to a certain degree, so kind of like high concept without any real kind of like reality borders. Mm-hmm. Inception, it's so clear what Inception is. It's a heist film, and each room of the heist, as you work your way through like the casino or the bank, is a different layer of the dream. Tenet doesn't have that. It doesn't have kind of like a concrete grasp of what its concept is. And whilst it means that it has moments that look very, very cool, it ultimately means that you don't have the satisfaction of being able to, like, visualise how the concept works.
Yeah. It's a shame, because, like, I think John David Washington is very, very good in it, and Robert Pattinson.
Robert Pattinson's great in it. Those two together are brilliant.
Mm-hmm. And there's certain scenes I will rewatch, but, yeah, like, I think this is the one where we talked about earlier, you could level the most at him of just... this film doesn't have characters. It is all just archetypes. The lead character is called the protagonist.
Which it doesn't earn, honestly.
No. There is like, this is quite an emotionally dulled film. Like, I don't feel anything when I watch the film. I'm kind of exhilarated every now and then,
when we talk about kind of like Nolan's scripting letting down its female characters, like Elizabeth Debicki's character in this really is just a plot point wrapped up in a dress, basically. Yeah.
And then you've got Kenneth Branagh's accent, which is a choice. He's also in Oppenheimer as Niels Bohr, by the way, which doing a slightly better accent, actually. But still, you're like, Kenneth, what are you doing?
I just think he just loves doing it. I think he's seeking out roles where he can do weird accents.
He will never stop being Poirot now, will he?
Yeah. Yeah.
He's just in his Daniel Craig era of, I'm going to do silly voices. But yeah, Tenet is, I think I'd have it like one above that on my list. But yeah, I wouldn't have it much above. But yeah, there's some great stuff, including the score. The opening is amazing, that like opera house scene.
Oh God, yeah.
It's amazing.
And just the moments where you get the backwards kind of like almost... it's like, you know, the voices in Twin Peaks that go backwards. It's like seeing that, but in action format. Yeah.
How do you feel about Tenet? Fairly similar, Matt?
It's fine. I do think the spectacle stuff is really good in it. Like, I even think that scene where they're fighting themselves and it's shot as if they're just, like, attacking, but actually they're just trying to escape is really interesting. But it sucks.
Yeah. I wouldn't go that far. But
within the space of a sentence, we've gone from it's okay to it sucks.
Yeah, that's me. That's what I do.
I just remember watching it going, but still thankful that there is someone in the world making these films. So yeah, I'll always be thankful for that. That's number 9. Number 8, we have The Dark Knight Rises, which I think is fair enough. Again, I think like a 7, a perfectly fine film. It's just... following on from The Dark Knight, it was always going to be a tough job, wasn't it? Especially
that is
when
its
you...
difficulty. Yeah, exactly. Any other, like, without the having any of the other lineage behind it, I think it holds up as a perfectly fine film. But he's made two better ones.
Yeah, especially when you've got the specter of Heath Ledger unfortunately passing, and then everyone thinking, oh, like, I can't wait to see what happens in the third one when they tie off with Joker, and we'll never get to see that. It's just, he was put in a tough spot, wasn't he, with this one? And I don't, again, there's a lot to enjoy in this film. I did rewatch a bit recently, and I forgot just how ridiculous Tom Hardy as Bane is. Like, how that voice is laughable. But, like, at the time, I was like, oh, this is kind of threatening. But now I watched it, I was like, this is, like, why did they choose to do that
voice?
Sounds
a bit like Kenneth Williams with a robot mask on.
The more I thought about it, the more odd it is.
It does mean that it allowed the parody version of it within the Harley Quinn TV. Yeah, which is some of the best, like, it's the reason that that show exists for me, really, Bane voice.
He does know how to open a film, though, and that, like, plane sequence, like, it is amazing. Again, like, another great use of practical effects. He is great at that. And it does, it ties up the story fairly well, I think.
Yeah, I think almost this one feels like it's a bit at war with the two aspects that Nolan sets up, in the fact that kind of Batman Begins is much more kind of like, even though it's a very, very modern and quote-unquote realistic interpretation of Batman, it's much more reliant on comic book elements than The Dark Knight is. The Dark Knight really is his own deal. And this one, because it wants to come full circle, right? Like, it brings the Ra's al Ghul stuff back with Talia, and it goes quite comic book at the end with, like, the race against time to stop a nuclear bomb. All of that feels quite different to the very heavy sort of, like, realistic investigation into vigilantism that is the second film. And I think kind of like that last kind of chunk of it falls off. But I do think there's lots of really interesting things to do with Bane's kind of like assault on Wall Street and all of that kind of style stuff.
There's no money here. Why are you here? Sure, I should have done Bane voice for that. Yeah. I love the bit that Nolan says during your interview with him, by the way, about how in The Dark Knight Rises, the atomic bomb going off is a moment of relief for the audience, and he wanted to totally change the perspective on that. Yeah, like, him making that point was like, oh, you're good.
He thinks about everything, doesn't he? He's quite good at making films. Let's stay in Batman land. Number 7, Batman Begins. A very good film. We're getting into, like, from here onwards, pretty much all bangers, really, to be fair. Batman Begins. I haven't watched this in a while. I might watch this weekend, actually. I'm going to go on a bit of a Nolan binge, I think. But I remember at the time when it first came out, I think maybe I was a little bit young to fully appreciate what he was doing with it, and thinking, oh, this is cool, but, like, I like the supervillains. Like, Ra's al Ghul and Scarecrow, they're not my favourite. I want, like, Joker and, like, Penguin and things. In hindsight, like, watching Oppenheimer as well, like, Cillian Murphy's Scarecrow is brilliant in this film.
So this was the film that got me back into... I was into Batman as a kid. I had, like, all the Batmobile stuff, and I used to watch the animated series. And I loved the Burton one when I was a kid, but I hadn't watched, and arguably, you know, that's understandable, right? Like, the Schumer films were duff.
Schumacher, yeah.
But I hadn't really followed any Batman comics at that time. But this, I remember what my history teacher put the first hour on when we just not got anything to do in history one day. And I watched that.
Which is weird, because history keeps happening, so it's almost, you'd never run out of it.
Exactly. Weird. I mean, maybe she recognised that Nolan was making history with his interpretation of Batman.
I'm just like, I'm jealous of all the kids now who get to study the Cold War and stuff, and now get to watch Oppenheimer at school. Like, that's a whole afternoon. What a treat.
But kind of seeing this interpretation, and I think kind of at the time, because the MCU project hadn't booted up at this point, it was special in the fact that, like, it was very clearly something different to the Raimi Spider-Man films, but it hadn't necessarily, because we weren't in the era of comic book movies, it couldn't really show how different it was.
No.
But in hindsight, this really is a special kind of, like, idea.
And you mentioned the MCU as well. It's interesting that I think it's a year or two before Batman Begins, DC actually rejected Joss Whedon's pitch for a Batman reboot, which could have been much more like the Avengers style.
Well, that's his vibe, right? Like, he's partially responsible for the MCU vibes.
So I'm glad they went this way with it for many reasons. But I need to watch this film again, but I do, again, like, he put his own, this is actually fairly linearly told for a Nolan film. Most of the Batman films are really those ones that keep it in check, but it does bring in some of his twist elements, which is a really cool twist, I think. I didn't see it coming the first time I saw it, with the whole Ra's al Ghul reveal. Yeah, I need to revisit.
It's also the real start of his stamp of creating what we consider now as kind of like the complex smart blockbuster film. Mm-hmm. It is a film about a man that dresses as a bat that goes around that has like historic IP. People like it. People like Scarecrow. People like all of that comic book stuff. But it is a proper, you know, in many ways it's a little bit of a deconstruction of what the Batman myth is, mm-hmm. but it's smart about it. You know, it's put together and it puts trust in its audience to follow, you know, that twist of Ra's al Ghul. It puts faith in the audience to watch a film that at the time was very long. You know, all films are this 2.5 hours long now, but at the time this was a big, long mm-hmm. film that put trust in its audience. And I think, yeah, that it's where you really see Nolan as a kind of like blockbuster filmmaker come together.
Yeah. Very, very good film. There we go. That's the number 7. Number 6 is Memento. And I realise I made the mistake saying Insomnia was his second film earlier. Whereas, in fact, Memento is his second film. And I'm a fool. Again, I haven't seen Memento in a while. But what a just, like, him and his brother wrote it together. And for your, like, first proper, you know, film. What an incredible screenplay. Like, I can't even... This was one of the first ones I remember watching this when I was, I don't know, 15, 14. When I was really properly getting into film, like, and doing media studies at school and thinking about, like, oh, maybe I'd like to make films. Never have, but, you know. And just, like, looking at the screenplay for this and being like, how do you write this? Mm-hmm. Like, how does this come together?
I had a really similar experience with watching this at like a really young age as well, and like recognizing that I don't think that a film had made me feel like that before. Like, yeah. Using the language of film in order to tell a story that you probably only really could through a movie. Mm-hmm. Like, why have you chosen to use this medium over anything else? It really, really stuck with me.
It's worth pointing at this point, like, if anybody hasn't watched Memento, yeah, it's told backwards,
in
right?
In reverse.
And what fun story from this is, so I watched this when I was about 18, maybe. It was just before I went to university, I think. And my friend had watched it and said it was shit and didn't understand why anybody had been speaking about it. And it turns out that she had got a pirate copy of it.
Oh,
and what they'd done
no.
was they pirated... On the bonus extras on the DVD, you can watch the film in the correct order.
Great.
Well, the chronological order, yeah. Like, yeah, if you don't, this film is basically, yeah, it played in reverse, but through the eyes of Guy Pearce's character, who is an amnesiac, and basically is trying to piece together what has happened to him over the past, like, week or so, is it? Mm-hmm. Well, it's not even that long, maybe. But, and there's, like, he's got, like, Sharpie drawings on his body, he's got, like, pictures, and it's just... expertly constructed. Like, for this to be your like second film, like, how old was he when he did this was 2000 he was 30, he was 29 30, yeah, when he made this. It makes you sick. Frankly, it's like when I look at Paul Thomas Anderson doing That Old Blood when he's 30, I'm like, grow up. You know, well, yes, he's grown up much more than me, basically. But yeah, this doesn't have, like, it has the hallmarks of a Nolan film, and as much as the non-linear narrative and the reveals and the twists, it doesn't really have any of like the action that you come to expect. Because for such a cerebral like filmmaker, he is actually, a lot of his films are just action films.
They're
he's a great
films.
Action filmmaker. Yeah.
This is the clear kind of, this could have been what Nolan could have become, right? A more of a cerebral,
almost like an Aronofsky sort
kind of like a filmmaker in that way of that kind of like wanky people like to claim is the only way that you can make films. But the thing that I think is the most impressive thing about Nolan is he takes that and he brings it into what is ultimately mainstream cinema, but keeps mainstream cinema like actively interesting.
Yeah. I'm going to rewatch this one this weekend as well. I'm going to go on a tear with these. But very good film. Memento. We're in the top 5. Number 5, Interstellar. I love this film. despite having it at fifth in my rankings. It's still very, very good. Like, it, I think we're the ones that have this highest, me and you, Matt. I think everyone else had it a little bit lower.
And it's funny because I still have like some sharp criticisms against Interstellar. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Oh, it's not a, oh, it's by no means a perfect film, but up until Dunkirk, it was the film that hit me emotionally the most. I like all this film. I know a lot of people have problems in the last maybe half an hour of this film where it goes and how obtuse it goes. Okay. I actually have problems with the last like 2 minutes of this film, but I'm not going to spoil it for people who haven't seen it, because I don't think you've seen it, right, Matt?
I haven't.
Again, we talk about, he knows how to get a good score, and this is when he was like at the end of his like Zimmer collaboration period, and the score for this is unbelievable. The effects are unbelievable. It looks amazing. Again, I think the story and it is, and the emotional parts of it hit for the most part. But yeah, I can understand why people think it goes a little bit off the rails. He's tried to make 2001, which is his favourite film. He stated multiple times, and he doesn't quite get there with
it. I think it's kind of like this idea of kind of almost love as a conceptual science, which is all I'll say so that Matt doesn't have the rest of it spoiled. I think sometimes it goes into weird kind of like positions that I think it struggles to manage with. But I do think McConaughey and his kind of like famous crying sequences in this are like, probably out of all of his films are the bits that kind of like, other than Dunkirk, is the stuff that really does tug for me.
It's the bit early, like there's obviously the famous one where he's watching The Message back, but it's the one early on when he's leaving the house to go away that gets me, and his Murph's just running behind.
Some like you say, in terms of like production, fucking hell, this is a beautifully
that big
produced
wave.
Film.
Oh, good.
Like, the idea that you had to like design a new type of physics to be able to know what to shoot on camera is the thing that got me about this movie. Changing how people interpret black holes in order to just make a little American blockbuster movie is, that's exactly. Great.
Most filmmakers would just make a sci-fi film, whereas he co-wrote it with Kit Thorne, the actual physicist, and like properly made sure as far as we know as human beings makes sense.
In terms of the mechanics as well, like obviously it's quite famous for the docking shot, which obviously involves an awful lot of rotation.
Swells.
Yeah. Like the music, the miniature set that he built for that, which obviously wasn't exactly miniature, it was massive, but or the way that all of that connects together, it's got NASA punk in terms of its design style. It did that before Starfield came along, right?
Yeah. This is why I want Starfield to be a bit interstellar-y, if I'm honest.
I think it's going to be Fallout in space, mate.
I want a bit of Interstellar in there. I remember I've seen this film twice in IMAX. Like, if you can see this film whenever they re-release it in IMAX, that's the way to see it. Cause this is the one. Same with Oppenheimer, incredible in IMAX.
If you see it as Croppenheimer, don't even bother.
Interstellar in IMAX is an unbelievable time. I think that did it come out like? Let me just check this. I don't want to get this completely wrong. It came out fairly close to Arrival, and I remember both of these films kind of exploring similar things and both of them kind of crushing me in the cinema.
Also, actually, if we can have a moment to talk about Arrival, like that's another one of those movies that I saw at just the right time to then think about the language of filmmaking. It's a film about like the assumptions that you make through film language, which I don't know about Interstellar. Does it have that? Because I like Arrival a lot.
But also, it has a bit of that, but not to the same extent. Yeah.
But also what I will say there is, you know, we're doing those soon. Both Denis Villeneuve and Christopher Nolan, I think, are the two examples of the intelligent blockbuster. Like, I wish we got a few more directors.
Or if they're not, they should be best friends.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I wish we got a few more directors like that, but it also, I guess, the scarcity of those films does make them, to a degree, what they are, right?
Yeah. That was Interstellar at number five. Number four, here's where people are going to get really angry. The Prestige is at number four.
That's mad.
It's
how have we let that happen?
I mean,
I think I,
it's
mine's,
that, it's, it,
mine
it's
was
there
about
on my
four,
list,
wasn't
I think.
It?
It's five if you include Oppenheimer on mine. Obviously a brilliant film. None of these are bad films. Anything from seven onwards is a very, very good film, okay? I love this film to bits. It's just the films I have above it on my list and the ones to come are more my type of film and hit harder to me. Films like Dunkirk and Oppenheimer, which Oppenheimer's not on this list, but they're more my sort of films. And this film, while I have watched it about 10 times, once you do know the reel, it loses a slight bit of the luster. Not much, because it is highly quotable and very enjoyable. But I just, I can't, it did fool me. And I know that's the whole point of the film the first time. It's, are you watching closely? I obviously wasn't. Because the next time you watch it, you're like, why didn't, and we're not going to spoil the film. Okay. I'm just like, why did I never once question this character on screen who I've never seen this actor before in my life? And they, why do they look so weird and never speak? That's all I'm going to say.
Yeah, totally.
Like, why did I never, like, it,
and it is sort of maybe magic.
That's the genius
that way,
of it,
though,
making,
yeah.
Exactly. That is the, I know that's the whole point of the film. And maybe I resent it a little because it made me feel stupid. But it's just, it is a great film. It's a phenomenal film. It just doesn't have the scale, or it doesn't really have much emotion to it, I think. And it at the same time doesn't have that. It's a nicely shot film. It's not a stunningly shot film compared to a lot of his others. And again, like the score, I couldn't actually, if you play me the Prestige score, I don't think I'd actually be able to pick it out. But apart from that, phenomenally plotted film and just very, very fun, and could quote it for days. Like, you know, you don't know. It's not a quote, but Hugh Jackman saying, you don't know, is always going to be funny to me.
It's got, out of all of the things that then come above it, it's probably got the most fun ending out of all of them, right? Like, the where that journey takes you. But, yeah, I do agree with you in that I think that every film that we're about to discuss, as great as this film is, I think it's more of a demonstration of just how far the bar goes for Nolan as a filmmaker
and
than
it
is a slight on The Prestige, because The Prestige is brilliant.
It's brilliant, and it does kind of have that parallel with Oppenheimer. It's like Hugh Jackman's character, it's like, we did all this, but was it worth it? Was the cost worth it? You know,
that's, and it kind definitely of wasn't worth it.
No, you know, just mildly, an argument with like a little magic man. It's great. Yeah,
yeah. I think that's the thing that is really good about it, right? If, you know, having not seen Oppenheimer, if Oppenheimer is about people that are having to have like very, very frank discussions about changing the world with kind of like an atomic bomb, I sort of like the pettiness of The Prestige.
Yeah. Oh, there is pettiness. There's a great bit in Oppenheimer where it's the scene, it's kind of you're laughing out of the horrific nature of, like, I don't know if this probably verbatim was not the conversation I had, but when they're actually choosing like where the two bombs should go in Japan, and one of them's just like, oh, we can't do Kyoto, I vacation there.
That's a true quote, by the way. I knew that before the movie. Really? And as it happens, I like,
and
I,
you're just like, you kind of want to laugh out of embarrassment. You're just like, oh my god.
Yeah,
like,
it's genuinely a true historical fact that they didn't bomb Kyoto because he honeymooned there. Yep.
Yeah. Great.
Yep.
So, but two very different forms of pettiness then.
Absolutely,
of,
yes. Like, Prestige, unbelievable film. If you haven't seen it, just watch it.
People
just
driving themselves to madness over things that don't matter, basically. Yeah.
A very fun, probably his most fun film. Like, if you wanted a good time, it's not really, there's some sad moments, but, you know, ultimately a fun film about magic men. Not a fun film, but in my eyes, a true masterpiece. We've got it at number 3, Dunkirk. I know me and you, Matt P, we are the torchbearers here for Dunkirk, specifically. Yeah. I recently rewatched it at the weekend, cried 4 times. This film just hits me like an absolute train. I don't know why. And I'm not like, it's the, like, kind of the jingoistic nature of it. And I'm not like a patriot, but I'm not a jingoistic person, but
don't think it's the patriotism of England, right? It's the patriotism of like the human spirit of actually people coming through in the worst conditions possible to actually do something that mattered. Like, we're talking about things that matter. It mattered that people stepped up and
knowing it
brought people home.
It did happen, I think, is what amplifies it, right? And it is kind of like, it's a mixture of happy and sad tears, but I just, this is a fun, I think, just a phenomenally constructed film. It's only an hour and 40 minutes as well. It's so tightly, like, just like woven in, and not actually, I think some people think this film's complicated, and it's the way it like kind of constructs time. But I actually don't think it, on a rewatch, I was fully.
I think
like,
it's the just, first.
I knew.
It's the first time you watch it, right? Like there's yeah. there's a lot to take in terms of like because of it switching between so many different perspectives that run at different time periods. It doesn't tell you at all. Like there's nothing on screen to explain really. Like is there like a lower third at one point to explain like
it just goes like the mole 1 week, like a little bit of white text. Yeah.
I think again it because he expects a lot of his audience and trusts his audience to understand it. I think the second time you see it, it is very clear what's going on and it's not complicated at all. But I do understand that there's a complexity to it the first time you watch.
Score that runs through this film is phenomenal. Just the ticking of the clock,
the shepherd's tone, right? That's the whole deal of what this ticks around. The shepherd's tone is a musical kind of construct that it's a single tone, but it makes it sound like it's kind of like increasing or decreasing.
If you've ever played Mario 64, you'll
that's what he based it on, Mario 64, Dunkirk.
Big gamer, Nolan.
But it ratchets the tension in this invisible way. And
the release at the end is just... I think that's what we talked about. That is where the tears come from. Just that relief, that release, that just... No, you know exactly what's going to happen. But he just... He's a genius at building that tension and that. This is like the one of two times where that emotional relief, that just outpouring, I don't know, it just destroys me. Mm-hmm. And I'll never forget watching this film in the cinema for the first time. Like, as loud, like, it was so loud. The sound design in this film is unbelievable. You feel kind of a little bit shell-shocked like Cillian Murphy's character at times.
Yeah, the Spitfire stuff is absolutely incredible.
Tom Hardy is great, although he's doing a little... Not doing a Bane, it's just because he's got a mask on, but he's great. And Mark Rylance in this film destroys me. Kenneth Branagh in this film destroys me. Harry Styles in this film, actually not too much of a distraction. But there you go. I love... It's lovely to see Weymouth. I love Weymouth. I've been there a few times for family holidays. But I could watch Dunkirk over and over and over again and never get bored. Number two, I mean, people can know what number one is after this, aren't they? Number two, we do have The Dark Knight.
It's just a pretty good
film, isn't it? Film, isn't it?
He flipped a trap, didn't he?
What has been said about The Dark Knight that we, I mean, Heath Ledger's good, isn't he?
Yeah, it's to this day, it's probably the best comic book villain that's ever been on screen.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to deny that, isn't it? Mm-hmm. It's just, again, knows how to open a film. It's basically Heat with the Joker.
Yeah.
And I'm just, I couldn't love that anymore.
Like,
to be
honest, a statement to make as well. Kind of like, you know, you open your Batman film in the broad daylight with some dudes in a mask. You know, the whole kind of thing is, as you say, it's like Heat. It's got that tension. It's got that excitement. And then you just, at the end of it, you get the reveal of a Joker that's just not like a Joker you've ever seen before.
Yeah.
Just this complete kind of then 2.5 hours of this kind of incredible, like deconstruction of kind of like what Batman's relationship with the city and his job is, how kind of like, you know, the White Knight to the Dark Crusader kind of elements.
And it's like specifically placing it in the time period that it was filmed too, because it's a thesis on the national control state, like whether or not somebody should have the ability to, you know everything about you in order to keep you safe.
Yeah.
It's like, it's a movie that you could only make at the time that it was made that still holds up and manages to be the thing that you draw from for every movie like this in future.
Yeah, and it's where I feel like the practical effects work of his really came into its own. Like, that truck flip that they actually did is phenomenal. It's quite funny, like, watching The Bear at the moment, which obviously set in Chicago, being like, oh, yeah, these are the same streets.
Yeah, totally.
Like, choosing Chicago is a great choice. Gotham, I know he did that in Batman Begins, but it really comes into its own in The Dark Knight, I think. And
I wonder if people think that about, like, Glasgow now.
Yeah. And also you get him saying, "Where's Rachel?" which is just a great line, really, isn't it? There's the pool cue scene. There's just so many good scenes in this film. Like, this film is just great scene after great scene. And Gary, do you know what? Shout out to Gary Oldman. I know people love his Gordon, but like, I think it's sometimes understated how good his Jim Gordon is. He's really great.
I think it's just like you really see, you know, you see the undoing of a lot of characters in this film. You know, obviously the Harvey Dent story is the big undoing, but just watching Gordon, I think, kind of like increasingly realize how powerless he is. Like, most of his department is corrupt anyway, so he's relying on very few people. But like, he's just as a cop, he's got fuck all power against anything that's happening here.
Yeah, very, very good film. I don't know. Yeah, what else is there to say about The Dark Knight that hasn't been said?
Go check it out if you haven't. Yeah,
a very good film. That means number one, and I can tell you now that it topped 1, 2, 3, 4 of our lists. Not yours though, Matt J. But our number one film.
I'm keeping the dream alive.
You kept it real. Number one, our film is Inception. My, I think, 21st favorite film ever. Just so you know, it's. I will always remember. So this came out in 2010. I was 18 when it came out, and for like 2 years after The Dark Knight, like when I saw The Dark Knight in the cinema, I was 16. I was like, right, Christopher Nolan is my guy, and I'm sure so did about 20 million other teenage boys in the world. They were like, yeah, this guy knows.
I love directors. I love Christopher Nolan. I love Quentin Tarantino.
Exactly. And I remember the first trailer, like hearing the rumblings of what Inception was, and then that first trailer where you just see Paris fold out upon itself, and you're like, oh my God, what is this? And then the build-up to seeing this film, this is the film I've seen the most in the cinema when it first came out. I saw it 4 times when it was originally out. I will never forget watching this film and having my mind absolutely blown. Just watching this film and just, let alone writing this film and working out how it all comes together. But even just like the concept of this film, like going in someone else's dreams and doing heist, like it's just genius. I know he like originally pitched this years and years before, and it was going to be, I think, much more of like a horror film. But then he repitched it as like a heist thriller, which sounds a lot better. And he just, this was like, you can tell, I think this is the first film of his where you can tell his lifelong love for James Bond comes through. It's kind of a Bond film, but in a sci-fi universe. I have endless love for this film. And I think it's pretty much a perfect film, if you ask me. But there we go.
Yeah.
What do you guys think?
It's tremendous. Like, I've already spoken a bit earlier when we were talking about Tenet about some of the things that I really like about Inception. But I, from a pure directorial, you know, cinematography, all of that, it's absolutely incredible. You know, trust the audience to know what's going on. It's the thinking man's big blockbuster, right? Like, that says it all.
Yeah,
some might say it's his fourth best movie.
Well, it's IGN UK's number one Nolan movie, but yeah, it's just I might watch it again. I just love this film, and it's, I think it, like we talk a lot about the scores in this film. The Inception score is like, I think, head and shoulders above like as Hans Zimmer's best work, especially the song, well, the piece of music, Time, which has been used probably in about 1,000 pieces in the last 10 years. Like, what an emotive piece of music. And the end of that film, I know a lot of people are like, oh, it doesn't end. It's like, it definitely ends. That's the point of the film. It's like, I've never really truly decided whether I think what the end of that film really means. I don't really know if I need to.
Yeah, exactly. The people that kind of like are all like, oh, watch where the wedding ring is and all of this, and you've got to follow this element through. I just feel that kind of spoils the...
Yeah.
Like, the mystery is good.
Yeah, yeah. What film? I'm going to watch it again. Absolute genius.
You've got a whole weekend ahead of you.
He blew up a snowy fortress for real as well. Yeah. What a legend. Yeah. Inception, what a film. I do remember the rumblings when Tenet was releasing, like, is it an Inception sequel? Everyone thought it's like Tenet 2, like, is it in the same world?
It really bothered me how everybody was talking about Oppenheimer as if it was in the Tenet universe. That'd be tasteless.
That would be insane. Imagine if like there's a post credit scene of like John David Washington's character turn up and go, we've got to reverse this whole now.
He just comes through the big kind of time rotor thing that they've got.
Wearing a little oxygen mask.
That would have been awful. Anyway,
yeah. I want to see that cut now. Sorry, we should make.
I mean, if anybody is interested in something vaguely like that, there is a set of comics called The Manhattan Projects, which is very much a sci-fi reimagining of like the Los Alamos lab. That's got a bit of that going on in it, if you really want that.
Anyway, horrible. Go see Oppenheimer. Tell us what you think about it. Tell us what you think is the best Nolan film. IGN underscore UK feedback at IGN.com. I love it when we delve deep and say it, especially I love as much as Christopher.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Hello, my name is Alison Larkin, and I'm a writer, comedian, and narrator and host of the Jane Austen podcast. This podcast brings Jane Austen's stories to the 21st century, along with commentary from me and conversations with fascinating people who all share a love of Jane Austen. And of course, we had to start with none other than Pride and Prejudice. So join me as we embark on a journey through some of the most wonderful stories I know. The Jane Austen podcast with Alison Larkin is available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Nolan, let's quickly talk about a few games we've been trying out. I think maybe, I don't know if you'll be on next week, Matt, but we were going to talk about this next week once we played it a little bit more. We've played like 2 to 3 hours of Remnant 2, which I said we'll briefly talk about this game. I don't think a game has surprised me this much in a long time. I still don't know what I think of this game. All I know is that we both played it for a while, had wildly just ranging experience, highs and lows, and the only word I can come up with at the moment is interesting.
Yeah, I'll give our story in microcosm. I'll tell the quick version. So Remnant 2 has a dreadful introduction. The first kind of 40 minutes of it are the most boring third-person shooter that you could ever play. And then me and Cardi, because after you've played it's about a 45-minute introduction before you can play in co-op. And then so the end of the tutorial concludes with you find like this giant thing called the World Stone. And when you touch it, it flings you into a parallel reality. And Remnant is kind of a multiverse story in a certain amount. And anyway, Cardi has found himself, trying to find his way to my game. And he's talking some bullshit about a palace that I've no idea what he's talking about. Anyway, I get him into my game and we're walking around a forest that really is quite dull. It's just a lot of kind of glades between thicketed kind of corridors. And like, well, we fight a boss and it's got this kind of Dark Souls with guns element, which I understand that the first game was basically that as well. And whilst that boss fight is good, I think in general we're a bit kind of confused by it and it feels a bit like a game from about...
A little bit aimless.
Yeah. It feels like a game from about... Like a B-tier game from about 15 years ago. Anyway, I have a hard crash, and so I have to come back in. But I go into Cardi's game instead. Well, it turns out that when you touch this world stone at the start of the game, it can fling you to a number of different realities. There's not a set like progress for this game. And Cardi ended up in something that's a lot like Boletaria Palace from Demon Souls. And this place, right, whereas the woods that I was in was full of kind of like almost kind of like tree-like monsters. They were kind of almost like made
biblical
out of
angels in a way. Like,
well, yeah,
weird.
Yours looked like the angels out of Diablo.
Yeah,
and like, there were knights in there, and
it was
so we
infinitely
went
more interesting.
Yeah, and as we, the further we went through the, you know, at the start it felt like, okay, you're going through kind of like this palace that's got corridors and you know, rooms, and we're killing enemies and kind of like picking up loot and stuff like that. It's got a looter shooter element, but we then found a pile of bones, in which, when we used it, a little jester man jumped out of it. And every time you interacted with him, he did a dance. And then, after we'd done a few dances, he gave us a quill that we had no idea what it was. It turned out the quill you could use to complete the drawing of a door on a wall. And then this door opens. And then we get to, I'll let you, Cardi, explain the chess master.
I went to this area that was full of enemies, and then sitting at the end of this like grid of 3x3 rooms is this man who just wants to kind of play you this weird like chess puzzle game. So like, I sat there, and every time you lose that game, by the way, you get cursed, which is a bit like in Souls-like games where a portion of your health bar just disappears. So I lost that like 4 times in a row, thinking, this chess game must be impossible here. They want you to work out a different way. Then we spent about half an hour running around trying to kill enemies, thinking there must be a clever solution. Went back to the chessboard, and I just beat him, somehow worked it out. And then we got a magic bow, which then is kind of cool. And then we opened another door of a quill that took us into Bloodborne, essentially. And we fought a woman on a horse who destroyed us. So the first hour or so we played this game, I was like, this is bad. What is this? Yeah. Second hour we played this game, I was like, I want to play a lot more of this. What's going on here? Like, we've given this game a 9 out of 10. And I trust our reviewer that there is a lot to love in this game. It just seems a lot of it might be a little bit by chance, like, because this game, we've described it a bit, is a Souls-like co-op, Souls-like with guns. You can play it solo with like gear-like elements, a little bit of Borderlands to it, a little bit of like Outriders actually is probably more appropriate. And but the hook of it is, it's not really a story, it is a story game, but it's procedurally generated. Like, it randomly generates the level and the enemies and the story within it. So like, you can have a completely, just as we've proven here, if we'd carried on in Matt's game, we probably would have dropped it pretty quickly.
Yeah.
If we hadn't jumped into my game, which is actually, like, I'd happily play a few more hours, like, in the world I'm in. And you obviously have to visit all 5 of these worlds, I think, eventually in order to finish the game. But it's potluck which one you end up in first. You can re-roll the campaign. But, like, the one we ended, yeah, it's just, it's rare, I think we said it, it's rare you play a game, you're like, I've not played anything like this before.
It's like there's the randomization, which from, you know, obviously Travis, who wrote our review, has played an awful lot more of it than we have, from which I understand from him that there's like an A and a B plot scenario, and those scenarios have individual elements that can be randomized, plus the randomization of the levels. I also found out that the land that I was in, which is this kind of like this weird alien forest world, depending on the role that you have, that world doesn't look like an alien forest world. It can look like a bunch of caverns, or it can look like a bunch of almost like big sections floating in the sky.
I'm puzzled as to how you give an objective review of this.
I think the idea of these games, like, I didn't play Remnant 101, you played a tiny bit of it.
I've had about 2 hours of it and liked what I saw, but not enough to actually.
I know the idea is kind of the replayability of it. And that, obviously, the procedural elements of it build into that. But I'm just so confused, that, like, it's bold from them, is what I'd say. Because, like, you could so easily, like, for a game, like, there's not, people don't have a lot of time. You could easily, if it was me who bought this, like, game, I might have bounced off it if I were you, Matt, and, played a couple hours of that. If I was in my world, I'd be playing it for a lot more. It's like, I'm so confused. Like, I kind of really, really respect it, and I want to play it more. There's things about it I'm not sure about. Like, I don't know if I'm never going to finish this game. I can tell you that now. But I do want to play a bit more because it's fundamentally like the shooting's fine.
The shooting's pretty good. The one thing that I really like about it is I like it just how like bizarre it is. It's not just the construction of the game that it's, but as I say, like just finding like this little jester dude that eventually gives you a thing, or this completely silent man that sits at a chessboard and you have to play like this match three chess game.
Well, also in that forest, we found like a big water puzzle, which was actually like seemed like a fairly complex puzzle for a game that's a third person shooter, which we weren't expecting.
And this is the thing, you were like, I didn't expect it to have bits of mist in it. And to me, there's almost kind of like, it's got a little bit of Jim Henson like labyrinth in it, in that kind of like you just find these freaks that do waffle
like
on.
Labyrinth, yeah.
Yeah. They do waffle on a little bit in terms of like there's clearly a lot of lore. And from what I understand from our review, you do have to play like several roles of the campaign to understand the entirety of the lore. Mm. But they're quite beautifully designed creatures, like really weird character designs. And it's just, I like that suddenly like you could be just going around basically doing Borderlands style third person shooting, bang, 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 everything's dying, you're picking up some loot. And then suddenly you spend half an hour where you're trying to say, like, we've got this giant like rotating drum that we had to match cymbals on and put like rods through holes. It's very, very strange, and I kind of like how weird it is.
Yeah, I've not had an opening few hours of a game hit me like this in a while, where I'm like gone from thinking this is a 5 or 6 to maybe this is an 8 or not. Like, I don't know what I need to play a lot more of this, obviously, and I think we will play a bit more next week and maybe report in again. But like, it's truly unique.
I think in terms of, you know, it's a game that's set in the multiverse, right? And we've kind of had a few multiverse projects recently, you know, when we talk about Multiverse Madness from Marvel, that kind of never felt like it was weird. Like it's just Doctor Strange, and there's a couple of different areas that like, oh, New York's got some big flowers on it now. Whereas this genuinely does feel like, oh, these multiverses really do have like, it's clearly not got endless potential, but it's got a huge amount of variation, and each experience could be quite different.
Yeah, I'd check it out. It's not on Game Pass, I don't think. It strikes me as a good Game Pass game. You'd want to try and try it out, but
yeah, it's one of those where I hesitate to say go out and buy it because, like,
you might have a bad time.
Yeah, you might have a really bad time. And yes, you can obviously re-roll your campaign so you can start again and hopefully have better luck. Definitely know what you're getting. I would feel very bizarre. Imagine if you just didn't know what... I mean, exactly like
that's
what we
did. Like, I didn't do my research and I didn't know too much about the first one. Mm-hmm. I just thought it was like a Souls-like with guns.
Yeah.
I thought... I didn't realise there was all this to it. So, right. It's very intriguing. I think it's out today. Yeah.
Absolutely good on Gunfire Games for just trying something this weird.
Yeah, I'm into it. You know, try it a bit more. Briefly, we've been trying out a couple other things. Matt, you've been... I'm jealous I haven't had time to do it yet. You've been visiting Melee Island, I believe.
I have, yes. So Sea of Thieves obviously are doing the Legend of Monkey Island thing at the moment. It's split up into 3 chapters, of which I think they're doing a chapter a month, and it's the first chapter this month. You start on a new tall tale where you meet Captain Kate Capsize from Monkey Island 2, and she sends you off on a journey to try and find Guybrush. And this first one is set on Melee Island, and it is absolutely lovingly, perfectly realised. If it's not been clear on previous podcasts, Monkey Island is one of my favourite games of all time. And the recreation of this, the music, and it's the right music in the right locations, and it does the iMuse style thing where it fades the music in and out between the two different sorts.
Oh, very nice.
You go to every single place that you could do something in. So, like, you know, you have to jump off the pier because how Guybrush goes down the pier to get some stuff off the off the floor. You go down there, you go into the scum bar. Like, everybody that's in the scum bar in the original game is there, including the Loom guy. Loom guy is there, and he'll tell you about Loom.
Is the Swordmaster there?
I've not met the Swordmaster yet, but I get the... It's clearly built, it's one tall tale at the moment that will be one of 3, but this tall tale is obviously built into chapters. And at the moment, I can only go in like the main section of the town. Okay. So I'm in like the high street where like the voodoo lady is, mm-hmm. and the pirates of low moral fiber.
And the mansion?
Yes, the mansion. I've been in the mansion now. You know, there's the piranha poodles are there. But the thing that I think this is a really, really good use of Sea of Thieves. And the thing I really love about it is so I played a couple of years ago when they did the Pirates of the Caribbean one. And I thought that was genuinely pretty good. This is completely different to that, because what it is it's a Monkey Island game that is played in Sea of Thieves. So there's a little bit of action that's been in it so far, but it is a puzzle game. It is okay. You going from place to place, talking to people, picking items up, taking items to other places, fitting them together. It's a LucasArts adventure game. There's a little bit of combat. So you've got, okay. So I've had two... very, very mildly spoil it. You get some root beer and you can spray root beer on ghost pirates to make them explode. So there's a touch of combat, but it is mostly just walking around Melee Island like you do in the Monkey Island games. Mm-hmm. Well, certainly in The Secret of Monkey Island. And solving puzzles, talking to people, working out how to get into new areas that are locked off, working out how to break Otis out of jail because he's stuck in jail again.
Yeah, yeah.
And so all of kind of those elements, it does slip up a little bit here and there. So a couple of the puzzles rely on you having pieces of eight to buy things from the general store.
Yeah.
And those pieces of eight, you just have to like scour the world for. You just have to go around and pick them up. There are a couple of times where getting pieces of eight is a puzzle. Like you might have to try and convince someone to look aside while you steal pieces of eight from them. But there is quite a lot of just like roaming around, opening boxes, yeah. trying to find money so that you can buy things that you need from the general store. But outside of that, I do think like the quest design feels fairly, it's authentically Monkey Island as far as they can do with the mechanics of Sea of Thieves. Like yeah. it's not a point and click directly because obviously you're playing it in first person, but they are using the tools that Sea of Thieves has to make LucasArts style puzzles.
I'm absolutely going to play this. Do you have any idea how long it is?
I mean, I played it for about 2.5 to 3 hours last night, and I've only got, I would imagine, somewhere between halfway and two-thirds of the way through it,
There's plenty there. And it's, I might have thinking, like, weirdly for Sea of Thieves, which is a big co-op game, this is single player only, isn't it?
No, you can play it with other people.
I thought it was
But what I would say, it is single player in that kind of like, because it's doing Monkey Island style puzzles, there's not any case of like two people working together to complete a puzzle. It is very much kind of like everything to do is you do on your own. But, you know, it's not required any sailing yet because like you sail to Melee Island and I've not set foot on the boat since. And sailing is where you really do need multiple people to make the sailing kind of like, you know, work well. But yeah, it tugs at the nostalgia in me so much. It is, it's made by people that love Monkey Island as much, if not more than I do. And the voice cast is there. Like when I walked into the general store and it's the guy that plays the general store in the remake of Monkey Island 1, it's all these sort of things that I could not stop smiling.
Yeah, I'm absolutely going to play this. Can't wait. And it's free, right? As well.
Yeah. If you've got Game Pass or if you own Sea of Thieves, it is free.
Yeah, amazing. Incredible. Love it. I've also quickly been playing a new puzzle game called Viewfinder, which I'm sure it's been around for years, like little clips, this game, trailers. There's recently a Steam demo.
I played a little bit of as well. And it's bloody good.
Yeah, this is... I'm only halfway through. I think it's a short game. It's like 3 or 4 hour game. Mm-hmm. I played like an hour and a half or so last night, and I'm about halfway by the looks of it. If you're looking for something to scratch that portal itch, this is the game for you, I think. And it's got a bit of The Witness to it, which is one of my favourite games ever. Like,
but Cardi, how does it work?
Oh, should I tell how it works? It's kind of, it develops the more you go along, but the basics of this game are you're picking up Polaroid pictures of places, then you place those Polaroid pictures in the world to create basically portals to those worlds in the Polaroids, or bring things into that world that you need to complete puzzles in your world, basically. And it's so much easier. if you look at 5 seconds,
it is
this
really
game,
intuitive. It sounds complicated, but it's not.
Yeah, you'll know exactly what's happening if you just look at what this game is rather than me trying to explain it badly. So far, I'm really enjoying it. I really think it's great. I love a puzzle game like this, and it's also a great way of mixing art styles. So like these Polaroids, sometimes like you can go into a cartoon mode, it'd be like a sketched world, and like it's a really just like ingenious, clever way of doing that. The puzzles so far have been challenging, but never to the point where like I've spent maybe at most 5 to 10 minutes on one. Like it's been a good, that good level of satisfying, but never like I have no idea what I'm doing here. The last one I did, I was like, that's really, really clever. Like again, like when we talk about how does Nolan write these films, I'm thinking like it's tough enough to solve some of these puzzles. I'm like, how do you even think about how to construct puzzles like this? That like it's just constantly surprising. The one downside to it, I think I'm not into the story, and it kind of has this semi annoying narration going on the whole time, and I'm like, the beauty of The Witness to me is just I'm alone with my thoughts, like there's no music, there's nothing, whereas this kind of, it's got this like story it's trying to tell with this person talking to you the whole time. I'm like, I'd rather if you just didn't speak to me and just let me
see.
Play
this
it.
Is the this is interesting because I've known about Viewfinder for a while, and like I've seen all the stuff, but the one thing I didn't realize is that it hadn't, that it had got a story. And I was initially put off by the idea of like, I really liked the idea of the puzzles, but I was like, I'd probably want something that give me a little bit more of a hook to pull it through, because I'm not into The Witness because I don't like the isolation of The Witness.
Oh, okay.
Whereas in Portal, where you've got a bit more kind
so
of narration.
So this is much more Portal, like, yeah, you're being like led through like, oh, this is like, yeah,
is,
okay.
Is it cozy Portal? That's what I got the impression
a
of.
Little bit, yeah.
And
yeah,
I think that's that. My vibe. I think I'm into that.
Oh, I think it's very, very clever. Mm-hmm. And I'm only halfway through. I imagine it's going to get more complex, but I'm having a great time so far. And you can pet a lot of cats in it. You can collect rubber ducks and stuff
there,
like that.
There we go. If you can pet cats, it's already bought. I mean, it literally is. I have already bought it. It's just waiting to get around to it.
I bought it last night and played a bit. It's, I haven't finished it yet, but yeah. If you're
if you
need
to
scratch that itch.
Superliminal.
Yes.
I did. I thought I'd love it. I didn't in the end.
I adored it. I also played the Maquette too, which is a little bit similar to this, which I thought was quite bad.
I thought Maquette was very average.
Yeah, I got about like 2 hours. Well, probably Maquette's only about 2 hours, isn't it? I only maybe got an hour, then it didn't do it for me.
I my instant thoughts are Viewfinder's better than both of those.
Nice.
But not quite Portal or The Witness. Somewhere in that middle ground. But yeah, very good. Check it out. Let's get on to some. We've been talking a while. Let's go and send me your feedback quickly. IGN _UK feedback at IGN.com. Who's got the first one? Oh, it's me. I've got one here from Tom Crump.
Hi,
says
Tom
hello.
Crump.
Hello. I'm not Tom Crump. Don't know why I'm saying hello to you. Hello, IGN. Welcome back to my emails. As per last week's discussion about the best name for a gladiator, I have the one and only correct answer. Striker. Inspired by the seminal novel by author Steve Bruce. This is going to go over your guys' heads, isn't it? Steve
the
Bruce,
West
the footballer,
manager.
Wrote. He also wrote a football book called Striker, which is meant to be quite bad, I think. I'll be taking no further questions, Tom says. Respect the sea. P.S. Enjoy James Madison. See you at the King Power in 24-25. Little football reference there, guys. Spurs just signed James Madison from Leicester, and I will enjoy him, hopefully, very much. That's from Tom Crump. There we go. Neither of you guys were on last week when we talked about gladiator names, were you?
Matt was.
Were you?
Was I?
I can't remember. What was your gladiator? Oh, no, you were.
It was
right?
Torpedo.
Yeah, it was talk about what
think,
your gladiator
oh, no, it was
be.
Missile was your name.
It was. Oh, and didn't you say Wolves? Wolf because
wolf,
of
the wolf, Wolverine.
The Wolverhampton.
Yeah,
link,
yeah, Wolverine. Yeah. Your little wolf. Do you have one, Matt?
I thought about this after I listened to the episode. I think it's Javelin.
Oh, okay. Why?
I don't know.
Why not?
No, I asked my partner this after I'd listened to the episode. I was like, what would your gladiator name be? And she couldn't come up with one for herself, but said, oh, no, you're Javelin.
Why not? Yeah. I think we've got another one, email along those lines. Mm-hmm.
This one's from Billy Savage, who says, hi, guys. I've only just begun listening to this a few weeks ago, and I'm a first-time emailer. And found that it's freaking awesome. That's very kind of you, Billy. I look forward to every Friday to listen to your podcast as well as IGN's Game Scoop. Very kind. Based off last week's podcast, my gladiator name would be The Savage, as my second name is Savage.
I wonder
really
how you
match
that
my
one
personality.
Out.
It's not like Wolf's name was Wolf.
Yeah.
Love listening to you guys, and I hope to be doing something similar to you in my future career. What I love about this email, I'd like to put a little pin in this. Imagine 10 years from now, we're like working alongside Billy Savage, and we're like, oh, you remember the days we just emailed in to the IGN UK podcast?
I mean, I had that like about 10 years ago. I wrote in. I can't remember if that email was ever dug out, but I think it was talking about what my Indian takeaway order is. But yeah, I haven't changed, have I? There we go.
So yeah, it could be you.
There we go. And one more email of the Matt.
So this one's from Gareth Bentley, who says, "Hi squad, love all that you do to keep the world entertained. On Prime Day, I bought a Starfield machine, also known as an Xbox Series S, for £150 after following the IGN UK deals Twitter page.
As you shout well out, should.
Shout out to that guy. He's doing incredible things for my hobby, but horrible things to my wallet. We will pass on the kind regards to Rob." He says, "I have a PS5 and all the amazing..." He loves all the amazing third-person action RPG adventure games that they have. Things like God of War, Ghost of Tsushima, Horizon, etc. "Having had a look at Game Pass, I can't really seem to find anything to compare other than Mass Effect, which I've already played. Can you recommend any similar titles on Xbox to satisfy me before I absolutely throw myself into the Starfield galaxy? Cheers, and keep up the good work."
I cannot believe that they've given me an opportunity to do the meme again, which is just play the Yakuza games.
Yeah.
Well, I mean...
It's a good option. I made a little list.
So my main, like, unfortunate hard truth is that basically the PlayStation is the place for third-person action RPGs, and an Xbox doesn't really have a lot, like, particularly over the PS4 era. It was distinctly made that, like, if you wanted those sort of games, that's where you went. You went to PlayStation. And there's not that many, really, on Xbox.
I scoured the full Game Pass list, and I've got a few suggestions.
Is one of them Sunset Overdrive?
It is, yes. Yeah. Spider-Man, then you'll be into that.
Well, it's made by the same developer, right? Yeah, exactly. So it's the closest to that sort of... that kind of, like, open-world action-adventure hybrid vibe that sort of PlayStation has cornered.
I will say another one is, I wouldn't necessarily say go from the start and play it more, but Gears 5 has a little bit of it. It's a third-person shooter, open world, good story, and looks beautiful. So, like, Gears 5 is one worth checking out. You're not going to get... It has also, like, the sled thing from God of War Ragnarok, if you enjoyed that.
Yeah, so. I mean, I do think that Gears 5 is great. I really like Gears 5. And in general, like the Gears of War series as a whole, it's definitely not like God of War.
You're not going to get... You're not going to get the same sort of stories on Xbox. They have a different vibe. Mm-hmm. I've got a couple of, like... I do actually think it's a little different, but if you didn't play Psychonauts 2, I think Psychonauts 2 is brilliant. And it has a good story and great characters. It's more of a third person like action platformer, but it is very, very, very good. I'd recommend Psychonauts 2.
I didn't like it as much as the first one, which I'm not sure if that's on Game Pass.
Psychonauts 2.
I don't think they've got any of like the very early kind of Xbox games on Game Pass. It was definitely on like Games with Gold at one point, and you can buy it.
Yeah, it might be. I'm guessing it's backwards compatible.
On Game Pass are both Plague Tale games, which are kind of like, you know, a B-tier level Naughty Dog experience. And also, I always like to shout it out in case you never played it. Watch Dogs 2 is there. Watch Dogs 2. It's great.
Is Watch Dogs 2 on Game Pass at the moment?
Yeah.
Cool.
I've never played
2, actually. Yeah. 2 is absolutely... Brilliant. It's like one of the best games that Ubisoft has made in like the last kind of 15 years, basically.
Yeah, I love it. Amazing, amazing vibes. I love being there. Brilliant. And then I thought you might shout this one out. It's all the Dishonored games. They're kind of, you know, if you're looking for an action RPG, they're there.
Yeah, they are. They are. I'd say, like, they don't immediately come to mind when we speak of kind of like the PlayStation exclusives. But if you were looking for something to, I guess, break a little bit into that side of stuff, absolutely.
They're as close as I could get from looking at all those lists. Hopefully one of those does you well.
Yeah, if you like all of that, play Yakuza Like a Dragon.
Oh yeah, all the Yakuza games are good as well. Play them. Yeah, good stuff. We're obviously going to play some Oppenheimer music at the end here, because there are many Boppenheimers in the Oppenheimer soundtrack.
Gareth also said, by the way, because we were covering locations, he says, P.S. I went to Cardiff University at the same time they were filming Matt Smith's Doctor Who, and they used our lecture halls and campuses all the time. I'm currently on a complete rewatch of Doctor Who. And,
why?
Because Doctor Who's fucking incredible. Like, this is I don't talk about Doctor Who much on this show because I'm aware that it can have ups and downs with people's opinions. But the Matt Smith era is very, very good. And
is that where you're at the minute?
No. I'm two episodes away from the end of the Capaldi era.
Ooh.
Which actually means that we're about to go into a significant downswing. Unfortunately, Chris Chibnall's writing for Jodie Whittaker was not very good.
Did you thread the Torchwood episodes?
Largely because I only think that there's only one good season of Torchwood, which is that one where they showed an episode a day for a week. But hey ho.
Yeah.
There we go. A little bit of Doctor Who chat for you there to end things. Should we listen to some really menacing music? Why not? Okay.
Go on.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for two women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it, or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Lynskey.
I wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream, that's a Lemke special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz. And how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.